Where warp meets weft.
Where warp meets weft.
This is Weavecast with Sine Mitchell.
Hello, and welcome to Weavecast. This is episode 56, the first episode of 2011. Now, the bright and shiny new year is often a time for making resolutions. Is one of yours to finally get serious about selling your weaving? If so, I've got a treat for you. Sarah Pilgrim, a talented and successful Montana weaver, is our guest this episode. And one of the main topics of our conversation is how to sell your hand-woven items online and elsewhere. And after that interview, I will come back with this episode's audio essay, Fear of Finishing. But before we jump into the interview, I have a bit of news and a listener question. First of all, I have a thank you to send out. Prue in Australia sent a donation to Weavecast as a holiday gift to her friend Linda in the USA, because they both listen to Weavecast from opposite sides of the world. Isn't that sweet? It's the first donation I've received in months and months, and it really made my day. Thank you, Prue and Linda, and thank you for listening. I have a listener question. Sandra asks, what rigid heddle loom would you recommend for a new beginner? Now, because I teach rigid heddle weaving, this is a question I get asked all the time. What loom should I buy? Unfortunately, the best answer to this is go try out a whole bunch of rigid heddle looms and see which one works best for you. I have my favorites, but that doesn't mean that that loom is going to work for you. So I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the rigid heddle looms I've used and what I think are the pros and cons of those looms. There are many other rigid heddle looms that I haven't used. So if I don't talk about a loom, it's probably because I don't have much experience with it and I don't feel qualified. The looms I own are a Shack Flip, a Shack Cricut, and the Ashford Knitters loom. So I'm going to talk a bit about those, and then I'll talk about some other looms I've seen in class. The Shack Flip is what I use as my teaching loom. The ones I've had for several years. I have like the little 15-inch flips. And I just throw them in, you know, one of those cheap plastic IKEA bags, and I throw four looms in there and they clatter around and I throw them in the car and I pull them out and students beat on them. And years into teaching, they still look brand new. So the Shack Flips are built tough. They are also one of the only rigid heddle looms I've seen that has an extra threading slot. So when you're threading double heddles, you can actually get your hands between them. It's really nice. The Shack Flip, I think, is the one that is the best setup if you want to do double heddle work. The downside of the flip is that because it's such robust wood, it's heavy. I mean, it's not like kryptonite heavy, but it's not super light. You might want to heft one or go online and read the stats about what they weigh if you're looking for portability as your main function. If you're looking to do multiple heddle work, I highly recommend it. The Shack Cricut is a non-folding rigid heddle loom. It's one of the smallest ones out there. It's about the same size as the Harrisville Easy Weaver. Even though I think it was scaled to be a kid's loom, it's still a great loom for grown-ups. The downside is it doesn't fold, but I have found that if you pack it first in a roll-on bag, you can get it into the roll-on bag for an airline and then just pack your clothes around it. The downside of it is that because it's engineered to be small and it's going for compactness, there's not a lot of space behind the heddle, which isn't really a problem unless you're trying to do textures and patterns a la Betty Davenport. If you're trying to get a pickup stick behind the heddle, it's a bit fiddly. Other than that, I think it's a great little loom. The other loom I have a lot of experience with and is in my collection is the Ashford Knitters loom. This was one of the first folding rigid heddle looms to come out, and it is wonderfully light. I have one of their 12.5 inches. You can get a padded bag from Ashford that it fits in, and it's super light and it fits underneath the seat in front of you if you are traveling on a plane. So it's wonderfully compact, wonderfully light. The downside to this loom is that because it is so light, the wood is getting dinged up. So it's that trade-off. If you're optimizing for lightness and ease of travel, you're going to pay a price in that your wood's going to be softer than if you go with hard rock maple. Some other looms I've had in class that I've not worked with directly, but I've seen a Le Clerc rigid heddle in the class this past weekend. We had one of those, and it was fun. It was a big loom and non-folding, so portability was not an option, but it was very sturdy, and it seemed to work quite well. The only downside was, I don't know if it's designed to work with a frame or not, but we weren't able to lock that one to a table. We kind of had to gerrymander a way to keep it from sliding around while she was weaving. Other looms I've seen are the Kromsky Harp. It's a folding loom. I've had a couple of those in class. And the Glamocra Amelia is one that I am currently learning about. At Madrona, I'm going to get a lesson from Joanne Hall. And hopefully I'll have a good review for you after that, when I know a bit more. Though, again, I caution you, the best way to find the rigid heddle loom that's going to make you happy is to try it out. Because, for example, I think the Shack Flips are great. That's what I generally use as my main go-to weaving loom. But I've had students in class whose arms weren't as long as mine, and they found it incredibly uncomfortable to weave on that. So even a loom that might be a wonderful loom in and of itself may not work for you. If you're lucky enough to have a weaver's guild, ask some of your weaving buddies if they have looms you could try. See if you can get to a conference and try out some looms. Or go online to some of the Yahoo groups and ask around, see what other people think. And good luck! Getting a new loom is exciting. And the good news is, if you get a loom and it's not the perfect loom for you, I think I'm an example of the fact that you could maybe own more than one rigid heddle loom. It's okay. Just a reminder about the listener questions. If you submit a question to Weavecast between now and March 30th, even if it doesn't get used on the show, you'll be entered in a drawing for Peggy Osterkamp's great new book, Weaving for Beginners. It is a big book, and even if you are not a beginner, there is lots of great information in there. So please go up to weavezine.com, click on podcast, and ask a question, and let me know what you want to know about weaving. This episode's interview was edited by Ruth Temple. In addition to sharing her audio production skills with the show, Ruth is a font of enthusiasm and encouragement behind the scenes. Thank you, Ruth. You are just awesome. Ruth, along with Nancy Smith Kilkenny and Laura Fry, are some of the folks who help make Weavecast go. Many thanks to you all. And now we've got an interview with Sarah Pilgrim, a talented Montana weaver.
My name is Sarah Pilgrim, and I'm from Wilsow, Montana.
Welcome, Sarah. I'm delighted to have you on the show.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you also for producing Weavecast.
So how did you get started weaving?
Well, I started weaving, as many other weavers did, in 1978. I took a 5-week course, and the way that came about is that I was working at Marshall Field's department store while working on my master's degree. And a friend was taking the weaving course, and I asked her what it was all about, and we ended up taking it together. So it was in a weaving shop, and of course, as many weavers also do, I ended up buying a loom from that shop. I learned the basics there. I ended up with a Lervaud loom, which was made by the Lervaud Company. It had been a furniture maker, and they decided to make looms. I didn't weave seriously from about 91 to 2002 because I started a company and ran it for that period of time.
What kind of company was that?
I started a translation company. We translated into foreign languages, all the major business languages of the world.
Oh,
so we translated,
cool.
Yeah, marketing materials and technical manuals, things like that.
So that means you can read all those cool books in Swedish?
No, not at all. I happen to speak French, but we had other people doing the translation. But now I live in a town of 300 people, and there are two serious weavers here, or I guess were two serious weavers. One of them has since moved, and they helped me get back into weaving, where to get supplies, that kind of thing, in 2002. So I've been seriously weaving, really, back at it since 2002.
So I'm curious, is weaving now your main occupation?
Yes. Although, as most weavers will know, I cannot make a living from it. It's just a little too slow.
What made you want to switch from working with translations to weaving?
Well, when I took that 5-week course, there was something about weaving that I knew it was going to be a vocation for me in one way or another later in life. I also knew that at that time in my life, I had to be making a living and be pretty serious about that. So the two didn't combine at that time. As I said, that as soon as I sat at a loom, that there was something kind of visceral about it that connected me to the fiber and to the whole process. When I came back to it, that's when I decided I had the time now at this point in my life to be serious about it.
Cool. So do you specialize in one specific type of weaving, or do you weave a variety of things?
I do. I specialize in shawls, scarves, and more recently, garments. I describe my work as fine hand wovens, and by that I mean I use fine quality fiber to start with, and that I weave it well. When I started using that phrase, fine hand wovens, I was actually weaving in 62 silk. So wow. The word fine also described the size of the threads, which is kind of an understatement, actually, the word fine applied to 62, I think, because it's pretty hard to weave with. I now weave mostly in 22 silk or 10-2 or 8-2 tencel.
Mm-hmm.
And that combined with the scarves, shawls, and garments kind of describes my work. Most recently, I've started using bamboo, which I really like a lot. Combined with tencel, it makes a beautiful fabric for garments. I've developed some approaches to designing stripes that are kind of interesting. This is one of the things that makes my work unique. Designing stripes using mathematical formulae. In one piece, the so-called stripes are actually lines of huck that occur in a plain weave ground. And the lines of huck are arranged in a mathematical formula called Pascal's triangle. You could do the same thing, for example, with the Fibonacci series, making stripes of huck following that series. So I like to experiment. I like to push my knowledge in both the design and the execution of my work beyond standard drafts. Another characteristic of my work is that my colors are somewhat bold. They're rarely muted. I also teach that stripes class.
The Pascal's triangle thing is interesting. When you're selling a weaving, do you share those details with the potential buyers?
If I'm face to face, I will. I'll actually lay the piece out and show them the sequence. That's one of the difficult things in online selling. You don't really have that opportunity. I suppose I could explain it on the website or explain it in the description of the piece. But generally, only would I do that face-to-face.
Oh, okay. I often think that things sell better if you tell the story behind them, the inspiration.
Do you? I think that's a good idea. I think I have to go and make some changes to my website. No, I'm serious. I think one piece in particular is the piece itself is interesting because of that Pascal's triangle sequence. Mm-hmm. And if I explained it, it would be kind of interesting to, yeah.
Well, I know I've been suckered into buying yarn simply because it was named after famous women and they had the story of the woman right there. And I was like, this is such a marketing thing and I am so buying this yarn.
That's a great idea. I do tell this story of my inspiration. For example, many of my shawls are sunsets that I see from my studio or early morning light that I see from my studio here in the Rocky Mountains. So I do tell that, but to even go into more detail and talk about the mathematical formula would be an interesting point.
Now, I know some weavers specialize and some provide a variety of things. Why did you specialize in one specific type of weaving? Did you think that was important for your business?
I think partly because I like scarves, shawls, and garments. And also, yes, it makes it easier for me, anyhow, to manage the fibers that I use. If I'm weaving a variety of things, for example, towels and table runners and scarves and shawls, I think it makes it harder to affordably maintain a good stock of the fibers that you need. For example, I'm not going to weave a towel in silk or tencel.
Mm-hmm.
So it helps manage that part of it. It also helps market it because you are a weaver who does X. Other people are rug weavers. I'm a scarf, shawl, and garment weaver.
Yeah, that makes sense. It'd be like if your favorite mystery writer suddenly started writing romance novels. It would be kind of confusing.
Or sci-fi, for example.
So at what point did you start selling your work? I mean, was it right away after you moved back into it?
It was pretty soon after that. When I got back into weaving in 2002, my two weaver friends and I did a holiday festival where we sold towels. We did pretty well and then did it a couple more times. It's a juried show, so that was a very good experience because more recently I have entered other juried shows. And so that first experience of having to apply was a very good one.
Well, that gets me curious. I've never applied to a juried show. It seems kind of daunting, is it?
No, it is not daunting. The only part that might be somewhat stressful is that you have to read their instructions and follow them. Most juried shows do not let you deviate from their way of doing it. And it's understandable because they may have 500 applicants for some shows. So they need to have it pretty well organized, and therefore you need to fill out their application completely. They don't have time to go back and say, wait, you missed this little part of our application.
Right.
You need to submit your work in the format that they ask for. Some people still ask for slides, even though most are now electronic. Just following their instructions is important. And that was a very good lesson, that this local holiday show that we did was a good lesson in how to do that and how to follow their rules and read their application carefully.
Cool. What were the names of your two weaving buddies?
The two weaving buddies are Bev Polk, who weaves mostly household items, for example, towels, table runners, table squares, and is a very accomplished weaver. And then Susan Lohmuller, who now lives in Lewistown, Montana. She is a rug weaver. Some people who are listening to Weavecast will have taken classes from Susan. She weaves rag rugs. And it's hard to say that they're rag rugs because they look way more sophisticated than some. She's developed a lot of drafts of her own.
When you sell your work, how are you selling it? Are you selling it online, in galleries, face-to-face shows?
That's really evolved over the years. In fact, the reason that I didn't continue with the holiday festival after having done it a few years is that I was selling at a local gallery and they were selling my work pretty well. So I couldn't really do both and do both justice. I just can't weave fast enough. So now I sell primarily online, and I made that change from the gallery to online partly because the owners of the gallery that was representing my work moved from Montana to New Mexico. At about that same time, I had developed my website, so the change to selling online was a pretty natural one.
So I know a lot of weavers aren't that technical when it comes to the internet. Was it hard to set up your online store? Do you have any advice for people who are trying to figure out how to do that?
Yes, I'm not sure how much advice I have, but it wasn't that difficult, partly because I did hire someone to do the website development. I didn't try to do it by myself because I am not that technically oriented. Here's how I looked at it. I thought, okay, I'm not paying the galleries their 40% anymore. So that's a quote savings that I can afford to put into the website. The website cost me about $600 to do, which when I looked at the overall sales that I thought I would be getting out of it, and it has happened, wasn't too expensive. So I wrote most of the copy for the website developer, outlined for him a general site map so that we knew what pages I wanted to have. For example, current work, testimonials, contact me. And he did a very, very nice job. He is an artist himself, so he understood what I was getting at. I also thought it was important at that time to claim my domain name because I wanted it to have my name. I think it's very important that a person have a domain name that is easy to find. I thought that most people would probably have heard of me maybe through a gallery or through a show I entered and then would Google me. And that is actually what has happened. I've made sales where people saw me somewhere else, looked me up, and then bought my work. And now I maintain the website, so my ongoing costs per year are about $150, which is the domain name, the hosting, things like that, which again, I look at as affordable because I'm not paying this gallery commission. I promote the website through email mailings and postcard mailings, basically reminding people that I'm here and trying to get them to the site. You asked earlier about going to face-to-face shows. I should clarify, I've really chosen not to do that because it takes so much time. I admire people who can find the time and still find the time to weave. I feel, for me, the monetary cost and the cost of time away from home and my looms is just too great. So I prefer to sit at home and hope that my website attracts people and that I can sell that way. And so far, I have made more income selling online than I made through the gallery.
Do you think that's because you had kind of an established brand through your time in the gallery?
Yes, I think galleries definitely have a place. I feel that they give an artist an excellent exposure. It gave me a very good start on getting known regionally. I happen to live near a town that is quite a tourist attraction. It's right on the Yellowstone River, a lot of fly fishing. It's 2 hours north of Yellowstone Park, and they were a good gallery. That helped a lot get my name out there. I would say that the galleries can be a very good place for a person who does not want to have a website. A good gallery will promote you. They'll market for you. They'll keep your name in front of the public.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no doubt that with fiber, a gallery can be helpful because people like to touch it. That is the downfall of the website. They can't touch it.
Yeah, given that it's so difficult to adequately represent textiles on the internet, what have you done to try to get across some of those things you like? Texture and handle on a website?
That's very difficult to do. I describe it. I am willing to send samples when possible, which might be sort of the end of a warp type of a little sample. I have sent thread samples so people can see and just feel a group of threads, a bundle of threads. That can help. There is no replacement for actually feeling and trying on the piece. I do let people send them back, of course. The other thing is the color can be a fooler, that we see a certain color on our monitor and it isn't exactly what we thought it was going to be. So that's the other fallback, is that they can return it. I haven't had that happen yet, but it certainly could.
Do you think it's possible for weavers who haven't had exposure in a gallery the way you have to set up an online business selling their goods and do well?
Yes, I do. I think that there are outlets. I'm not familiar certainly with all of them, but the one that comes to mind is, for example, Etsy. Mm-hmm. There are people on that who do quite well. You just have to be able to upload your photos and that's it. It's quite easy. So yes, I think it is possible. The one thing that is always the catch is you have to get people to it. You have to get people to know that you're there. And that's where maybe having a mailing list and just starting to accumulate your names of friends' friends can help, so that you can get the word out that you're there and get people to that site.
Exactly. Do you do marketing through postcards and things like that?
And email mailings. I try to get people's email addresses as much as I can, because obviously it's a lot less expensive than sending postcards. The postcards, of course, are photo postcards when I do it, and I just have them printed by an online source pretty inexpensively for color photos. So that's how I do it.
Cool. Now, the other part of selling online is you have to have a reliable and secure way to take people's money. How did you set that up on your site?
Well, I discovered through PayPal, it's very easy to set up a way that people can securely pay using PayPal. So on my site, it now says under a shawl, it'll say add to cart. And if you click on that, it's just like if you clicked on anyone else's site, it takes you to your cart and shows that you have just put that in your cart. Then you can return to the website and put more things in the cart, which is the idea, of course, or you can check out. If you establish a PayPal account, which is called a merchant account, you can very easily use their template and get that established on your site, get that button onto your site.
So even someone who's not technically oriented could figure that one out?
Definitely. Oh, it's very simple. I actually just started noodling around on PayPal's website and found it, and it's very easy. And of course, they do take a little percentage. I can't remember what it is, but it seemed very reasonable to me because it simplified the whole buying process.
Yeah, it's definitely better to have a click and pay now than to have people call you up, because I bet that's a barrier for sales for a lot of folks.
Yes, and that's how I started, and people don't want to go through that process. We're too used to the easy way of paying. We don't want to have to send a check. It's worked out pretty well. And let me repeat, I'm not selling enough to make a living at this, but the way that I'm doing it, I'm making more than I was with the galleries.
Good to know. So what advice would you give weavers in this down economy? I know a lot of people are looking at their looms and wondering, could they supplement their income through weaving? What advice would you give weavers who want to start selling their hand wovens?
The first thing I would say is do it if you want to. If you don't want to, don't. That's all right, too. Don't let other people pressure you into selling because they think that that's what you need to do. That's the first thing. But if you want to, do it. At Convergence in Denver a few years ago, I took a very good marketing class from Rebecca Bluestone. She advised us to enter every competition, every show, every reasonable opportunity that we could find and get our name, our work out in front of the public. And that's the advice I would pass on to weavers wanting to sell their hand wovens. It just isn't that hard. And if you think about it from, for example, the gallery owner's point of view, that gallery owner has to fill that gallery. So you can even view it that you're doing that person a favor by walking in there and saying, I would like to find out if you would be interested in representing me. They have a gallery to fill, and fiber is valid of an art as any other that's in that gallery. So don't be afraid to go and approach people. Just walk around and see galleries that you like, and would they be interested in your work? So that's part of the advice I would pass on. The other part of the advice is that be sure your work is of the highest quality you can make it. Once you've put something out there, that is your reputation. If you put something as simple as a towel out there and it falls apart, that doesn't get you off to a very good start. You want word of mouth to be that you have a wonderful reputation, that you do great work. Make sure also that your work is priced fairly for you and for the buyer. Don't forget how many hours it took you to make that towel or make that shawl and finish it, and the knowledge that you have that went into designing that piece. One last thing is, when you're thinking about selling your work, you need to think about getting a lot of mileage out of a warp. Put on longer warps and think in terms, for example, of doing 10 towels or 7 towels and a table runner. It's just plain more efficient to wind on a warp and thread it once and get a lot of items off of it. It's production weaving starting to think in those terms of making the work up front count for a lot.
Talking about production weaving, do you do the same thing over and over?
No, every single piece I make, and I can honestly say this, is a unique piece. If a potential customer sees a shawl that I have woven and wants me to do one exactly like it, I'll do the same colors, but it will not be the same shawl. The design will be slightly different. So every single piece is unique. And I have started recently painting warps. Mm-hmm. And I do it in a way that's pretty non-scientific, so that is completely unreproducible. So that even is more of a safeguard that you will never see yourself coming and going.
Well, that's really interesting. And you chose to do that deliberately, to never repeat yourself?
Yes, I think if I'm going to call it art, I don't think I can be making the same thing over and over again. So for example, I'll put on a warp of 3 shawls, let's say. It'll have a lot of colors in it, the warp will, but each weft will be different. Possibly each treadling sequence will be different. For example, if it's twill blocks, I won't do the same sequence over and over.
Well, that seems like a really smart marketing move. One of the strengths that a hand-woven garment has that mass-produced ones don't is that originality and uniqueness.
That's right. And that's, to me, what makes it art. If it's unique, you don't see an artist generally doing the same painting over and over again. The theme might be the same, which would be the equivalent of the warp being the same, but there will be variations on the theme. And I generally, just for the listener's information, put on 3 shawls at one time or 3 to 5 scarves at one time. The reason I don't do more than that in scarves and shawls is simply that it becomes difficult to make those variations on the theme.
Interesting, interesting. Well, I'm curious, what's been the most rewarding part of your current work?
The most rewarding part is to see a piece pleasing someone else. If I see, for example, a person wearing one of the garments that I've designed and woven the fiber for, I feel it's just very rewarding. And to hear someone rave about it and tell their friends, that's pretty rewarding. It's probably what keeps me wanting to do more, wanting to stay at that loom, the gratification.
Cool. Now, I know that among the rewards, there must also be some challenges. So what's been the most challenging part of your current weaving career?
Careers, it would be in quotes. 2 things come to mind immediately. The first one is time management. I think it is very difficult to do well, just to keep your household running smoothly, stay in touch with friends and family, and sort of have a life, while also dedicating large blocks of time to weaving. There's also the finishing work, twisting the fringe, wet finishing, pressing, and doing the marketing, as we've been discussing. So I think time management is a big challenge. I have partially solved that by keeping what I call studio hours, and that means that I weave, and by weaving, I'm at the loom from about 1 to 5 every weekday, excluding summer. I take summer off to design and paint warps and just have a summer. but I do try to stick to that. My friends know that that's my weaving time. I don't answer the phone during that time. And I've found that's the only way I can do it, guarding that time. I find that I have to do that, to guard that time in order to get my work done. It's not really work to me. I really like it. So it's not hard for me. It can be hard for others in my life who want to call me from 1 to 5, and I won't let them.
Ah, you sleep in. That's nice.
Right. No. I get up early and twist fringe. That's the morning. And then the second challenge that comes to mind is my developing the garments. That was a challenge because while I know how to sew, I am not a seamstress by any stretch of the imagination. So I had to find a seamstress with whom I could work both personality-wise and talent-wise. That seamstress has to be pretty willing to experiment a little bit and able to do that with me. My first garment was a kimono jacket, and my knowledge of how to get a garment to the right fit and still be a one-size-fits-most, which I wanted to have for the selling purposes, was very, very limited. And I'm fortunate enough to have found a very talented seamstress, actually, who lived in Japan for many years, I think 20 years. So she really knew how to make kimono jackets. And as a team, I think we've come up with some pretty special jackets. Wow. I've now sold 5 of them.
That was really quite a find.
Yes, it was. And in a town of 6,000 people, not my town, but the next town. So that's pretty amazing.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, what's next for you? What are you working on currently?
I am working on more garments. For some reason unknown to me, I like the idea of garments. So after the kimono jacket, I designed what I call a travel vest. It's a reversible vest with a nice little hidden pocket for your cash or your credit card. It actually won the most innovative award at this year's Anwag Fashion Show. It's an interesting garment because, again, I got a lot of mileage out of this warp. I wove both sides on the same warp, same threading, and I just changed the tie up halfway through. So I have an undulating twill on one side and a plaited twill on the other. I want to do more of these, probably on a commission basis, because since it's reversible, I think the customer needs to choose the colors for both sides rather than my just randomly making vests. The other one I have on the burner is a long vest. It's in the design stages along with another jacket design. And I want to do more warp painting on garments or on the warp for the fiber that's going to become the garment, because I think that can just be fabulously interesting as a garment. You know, lots of transitions of color that really can't happen without painting it.
Yeah, I love painted warps. They're gorgeous.
I do too, and I know you do some beautiful ones. So for reasons I don't know, I like designing and weaving the garments, well, the fiber for the garments. And as I say, I have a wonderful seamstress now, so we have fun doing that together.
Now, you mentioned commission work. Have you done a lot of work on commission?
I do, yes. And that could be something as simple as a friend of a friend sees my friend wearing a shawl that I wove and wants one like it. Or it could be something like a person sees my kimono jacket online, but it's not in the color that person would like. So they commission me to do one in a color that they want. And I sell my commissioned work at the same price as my other work. I'm not really sure why I do that. Some people charge more. I just think it's fine. Mm-hmm. Sometimes commission work pushes me to new colors that I would never possibly have thought of working in. So I take it as a learning experience. And so maybe that's why I price it at the same price.
Interesting. So if you're doing a commission and you're working remotely, you're not sitting down at a table with this person, I presume you mail samples of yarns back and forth and have discussions via email?
Yes, I do work long distance with some clients. So the way that I handle that is I do a sample winding the threads around cardboard so that they can get some vague idea of first of the colors that I want to use and then also of what the pattern will look like. And then, yes, we communicate by email, sometimes with photos also of the garment in progress. If it's a local person, I always invite them to come to my studio because people just love to see their garment being woven. I mean, that is pretty special. And they like to take photos of it. And then the other thing I have done is to send them a swatch of the first bit so that a person can say, oh, no, this isn't what I had in mind at all. And that's fine. So I weave that for someone else, and then we start over. But it gives them a chance to give me feedback once they actually see the fabric itself.
Cool. Well, that's an interesting way to approach commission work, is thinking of it as a learning process, because it seems like it would be more difficult than just sitting down and weaving something.
It is, because people have very specific ideas of color, and people see color differently. So you do need to have a discussion about color, a hands-on discussion, so to speak, where I'm showing them what I'm thinking about.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for sharing your time and your talent with us.
Well, thank you. It was my pleasure entirely.
So if we wanted to look at some of your beautiful handwovens, what is the URL of your website?
It is www.sarahpilgrim.com. And Sarah is with an H, and Pilgrim is just like the Thanksgiving Pilgrim.
Thank you so much.
And now it's time for this episode's audio essay, Fear of Finishing. If you've been listening to the show since episode zero, you'll know that I opened this podcast with a story about my early struggles learning to warp. Now, it turns out I have a problem with the other part of the process as well, finishing. I have piles of half-finished projects, scarves that are woven but need their fringe twisted, dish towels that need to be cut apart and hemmed, garment fabric that is neatly stacked with its pattern, and dust lightly covering them both. Are you like that too? Because I don't think I'm alone in this. On New Year's Day, I found myself at a fiber artist's open house where knitters and weavers and spinners and felters all gathered to work on our craft and discuss art and what was going on in our lives. Now, it was tremendous fun. And because it'd been on my mind for a while, I raised the question, why is finishing so hard? As soon as folks started talking, I wish I'd had a microphone on me. The answers were both varied and insightful, and some of the things that came out were, if I don't finish it, I don't have to accept its imperfections. The unfinished project still has the potential to be visited by that miracle fix that makes it better. That makes it fit, less itchy, smoother, less pink. Of course, the thing to realize there is that an unfinished project has one big imperfection. It's not finished. The second thing that came out was, if I don't finish it, I don't have to let it go. Sometimes we get attached to our projects and, like a good novel, don't want to see them end. I mean, not finishing them means they're still ours as art. In some ways, it's better to have a piece of woven cloth than a dish towel. Part of the process is still left. It's like savoring that last chapter. The third thing that came up was, I just don't like fringe twisting, hemming, sewing up seams, etc. And we talked about that because, you know, some people don't like warping. Some people don't like fringe twisting. I do not like fringe twisting. I think from now on, one of my goals is going to be avoiding fringe twisting as much as possible. I'm going to embrace the hem. I'm going to embrace bias tape. I'm going to put fringe behind me, at least for now. I may come back to fringe, but right now, fringe needs to be behind me. So what do you do if you just don't like the finishing process? Well, I mean, you could find someone who does and team up with them, but since I'm guessing that people who are willing to sew up your sweater for you or twist your fringe on all your scarves for just the joy of it are few and far between, I would recommend thinking about this. Is it possible to like fringe twisting, hemming, sewing up seams more than having piles of unfinished items that make me feel uneasy and guilty? Is it possible that actually doing these things that are not my favorite would be more fun than having to look at that pile of stuff every day and go, ah? I think so. I had an epiphany over the holidays. Life, as it does, got hectic. And so I had planned that this year would be one of those years where I make most everything I give. But things happened, and it was impossible for me to get to the loom as much as I'd planned. And suddenly, because all my relatives live at least 1,000 miles away, I had to mail out gifts that didn't exist. So in desperation, I rummaged through my stacks of unfinished projects and hastily hemmed and fringe twisted and washed and pressed. And when I was done, lo and behold, it was like a miracle. I had enough gifts for everyone. And when I was working on this, I had to go so fast that I did not have time to agonize over whether the hems were perfect, because I'm not a great seamstress, or whether I should repair that skip in the fabric. It's a dish towel. Does it really have to be perfect? If things were going to get into the mail in time for the holidays, I just had to just do it and just let it go. And it was so freeing to finish stuff up. I had been focused on all the fears around finishing that I'd forgotten what I loved about it. That sense of accomplishment and closure. It was like part of myself detached from the item when I finished it, and I got that energy back to go work on something new. Or maybe it was just that I was able to get rid of that tiny little voice that's always sitting in my subconscious muttering, "You really ought to hem those towels, you know. They've been sitting there how long?" Since that experience, I have been in a flurry of finishing. I've picked up projects that were abandoned, usually because I'd run into a problem or started something else and gotten distracted, or put the project down for so long I'd forgotten where I was or what I'd even planned to do. And that last one I found can be totally avoided if you simply start on the project and work on it a bit each day till it's done. I can't believe how simple it is. I mean, how come no one ever told me just start, work, finish? Ta-da! Bhakti Zeke shared a story with me from a book called Art and Fear. It's a great book, by the way. If you haven't read it, go get it. There'll be a link on the show notes. There was a study done where they took a class of art students and told half of them that they would be graded on quality if they produced a work that was magnificent. They would get an A. The other students, they said, "You're going to be judged on quantity. We don't care if it's good, it's bad, it's indifferent. Just make lots of it. Lots and lots. The more you make, the better your grade." And do you know what they found out? All of the significant work, all of the truly great art, came out of the second group. Yeah, the people who weren't even trying to make good stuff. The people who were just doing lots and lots of work. I've been thinking about that in my own work. I've decided it's more important to have forward progress than to be perfect. We learn by doing, by making mistakes, learning from them, and then making the next thing. I've been guilty of paralyzing my progress by demanding perfection. I mean, striving for excellence is good, but if it stops you from going forward, then it's not helpful. Since I've loosened up on the idea of perfection, my weaving has been going faster. More things are getting finished, and I'll be darned if I'm not having more fun. So what about you? Do you have problems with finishing? Why? Or if you don't, why not? Hey, I'd love to know more about how to conquer this. I'd love to hear your thoughts, either as written comments on the show notes, which you can reach at weavecast.com, or as audio comments on Skype. And you know what? I just finished this episode, and that's a real good feeling. That's all for this episode, and now it's time to get warped, because everyone knows you have to be warped to weave.
Most of the time, I just wanna dream, forget that I'm terrified with it. If I struggle for rhyme, is it even worth trying? Most of the time, I can't stand waiting. I wish with one try, I know everything. Lazy butterfly, hurry. Forgive my mistakes, but crying.
Our musical guest this episode is Josephine with her song, Unfinished Life.